So I'm really pleased to welcome Myra Connell here. She grew up in Northern Ireland and now lives in Birmingham, where she also works as a psychotherapist. And House is her first full collection of poems and is published by Nine Arches Press. So House contains really suggestive and mysterious poems, so that the reader feels, as Myra puts it, something encroaching like the tide. If I had to state what I've found to be the hallmark of this collection, for me, I'd use the word authentic. It seemed to me a really honest and hard-won collection of poems. And so I'm really pleased to have the chance to hear these poems and to explore them further in all their richness. So please welcome Myra.
Thank you. It's absolutely wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for coming out. And thank you for inviting me. I replied by return of email to Chloe's invitation.
Yes, I'd love to.
So House, well, we'll talk about it by and by, so I won't say too much about it now. But just to say that I suppose there are lots of themes in it, as of course there are in any collection of poems. But there is one theme that is to do with the house and the sort of metaphor of the way that the house could be thought of as being the self, the house and the self. I think, you know, that idea is sort of in here. And the houses and the selves are often rather fragile or ramshackle. And I think it might be the case with these poems. Maybe it is with all poems. I think it's actually quite difficult to listen to poems for a whole evening. I've noticed myself getting quite, you know, just full up and can't take any more. But I think with these particularly, it might be important to sort of let your brain or your whole self kind of relax, because maybe they don't make sense in a very straightforward way, but they might make some other kind of sense, a bit like dreams. So this one is called One. And there's a sort of a shape. The wonderful Jane Kimane, the editor from Nine Arches, helped me to make the shape of this collection. And in each section, of three sections, there's a poem that has a title, one, two, three. And I thought I might read all of those this evening. One. So here's the house. It makes the corner, stands where two streets meet, and looks towards the sea. One flat wave is foaming at the curb, the water green and icy. The tide is at the door, and yet the woman says it isn't high enough for bathing. That's a lie. She lied, the woman with the black and shining hair, to stop the other swimming. Out the window to the seafront, they could see the waves run in, slant and slant against the road. She lied, or both the women lied, needing one the other. Let's see. Here's one that's very much a kind of fragile self poem. It's called Landslide. I have a method with these tags, but it may not work. Landslide. It's in two parts. I carry water in a cup, alone and careful, careful, careful. It is bulging up, the water in the cup. It's standing proud for you who light my life. I mustn't spill it. I am charged with it, as charged the world is with God's grandeur, which flames out, shines. Light of the world, I will light your life too. Let me be your beacon. Light your life. She is carrying a cup. She hardly dares to step. Oh, sleep. Not one drop must be spilled. And look, it isn't drops, it's thicker. It's a solid thing, this water, how it bulges on the surface. It wouldn't be a drop that fell. A sheet, perhaps. A torrent. Let's see. And here's another fragile self poem. It's called Escape. Right, I'm going to put you out of your suspense and put down these two tags. Escape. This one's in three parts. A sea light in the room. I find a book she's reading, stone blue cover, flowered, slightly torn, the page turned over where she left it. I see her sandy tan. Her clothes are bleached. Her son is here and drunk and lurches in. He tells me I must leave a note. Squeezed by the fear of dying, I want to run away. There's sun on Friday, Southwold. Two round stones from Arran, from the beach at Shiskeen, weight the corners of the yard, hold me down like ballast. And here's one that's actually called On Arran. It's more about a broken down house, that's what I think. On Arran. Again, it's in three parts. Someone had lived there, we were out on Arran in Scotland walking, and there was this pile of stones, and you could tell that it had been a house for various signs, which are probably some of them are in the book, in the poem. But there were those orange lilies. You know, when you're in Scotland and you see those orange lilies, and they're from gardens, I always think. And that was what made me think, oh, I think there'd been a... And there's something, I grew up in Northern Ireland, and as children we were often taken round the west of Ireland by our parents, and we used to come across these deserted cottages where, you know, people had just left, sometimes leaving the teapot on the table. And so something very evocative for me about those. So this is On Arran. Someone had lived there in that pile of stones. The orange lilies showed it. Later, in the book, I read his name, Jimmy Neal, the Weltman. His wife was Jenny. They had come from Campbelltown by boat, attracted by the wave-made harbour, cleft in rock, with jellyfish today, three fierce purple, one a rusty star. And there they built the house of stones, with heather for the roof. They both collected whelks. She took them every Monday in a bag, and left it on the road to Drumadoon. I am swinging from the ladder, star splayed. I stepped wrong-footed, dangle. There was a sound that had to come, and though at night I'd loved you, in the morning I drew back. Now rain. 3 days downpour and the names of dyes. Weld with alum mordant, bracken tips and cochineal, and lichen from both wood and stone, onion skin, bog myrtle, otherwise the rain, the need to raise the spirits ere the coats. Children peer from fogged up windows. We crack and use the heating, standing by the meter counting. Nothing dries, no wind, an air that's turned to water. Even the seals no longer lollop to the rock to bask. Chloe asked me if I would read a couple of poems by poets that I admire and who have influenced me. I hardly like to say that Hopkins, Gerard Manley Hopkins, is one, because I think he's so utterly fabulous and he's my complete favourite poet. And I think partly I do like the sort of dark sonnets and the kind of way he writes about despair. And of course he is also a very ecstatic poet. I have chosen the more despairing of the two poems I had in mind, but I've done that partly because I just think it's so heartfelt, and that you can write about despair in a way which, because it acknowledges how one feels, it isn't despair-inducing, I think. Also, it's got spring in it, and I think we were... So this is, "Thou art indeed just, Lord." Thou art indeed just, Lord, if I contend with thee. But, sir, so what I plead is just. Why do sinners' ways prosper? And why must disappointment all I endeavour end? Wert thou mine enemy, O thou my friend, how wouldst thou worse, I wonder, than thou dost, defeat thwart me. Oh, the sots and thralls of lust do in spare hours more thrive than I that spend, sir, life upon thy cause. See, banks and brakes now, levered how thick, laced they are again with fretty chervil, look, and fresh wind shakes them. Birds build, but not I build. No, but strain, time's eunuch, and not breed one work that wakes. Mine, O thou Lord of life, send my roots rain. Okay, so I think I might finish this first half of reading just with one more. Two more, if that's
okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, I want to read this one because it has a different feeling and that it wants a different kind of voice to read it, and I think that's nice to do in readings. It's called Lexical. Do you love me enough not to mind? Oh, yes, I love you. Yes, love. And look away, and so I've lost it. Lost something again that mattered. You can put me out, it's fine. Can't put out my fire. That little book you lent me, I refused it. Too hot, take it back. I couldn't. Words, they're opposites, I so much want to. Read it. I would have had to wrap it, make a cover, put it on the mantelpiece beside the bottle ship, the soapstone cat, or lay it on the altar. Besides, a dictionary. Why borrow one of those? You were silent in your orange shirt. Or blouse, we used to say. Blousy, blown, your bedroom eyes. Somehow to escape, to find a garden with a fence. The dogs kept out. And I will make this the last one from this section. This one's called Beyond Llandudno. And it's also in three sections. The last farm rotting. Humans hide indoors and in the byre, hot deep, heifers, slurry. Voices to-fro murmur. A door upstairs, a footstep on a creaking board, a woman singing. Something, you said, is elemental. See, the cottages, the cliffs. The starlings flocking from the hinterland at dusk to peer roost on the metal struts. This old stone house against the sea, the empty grate. And sunk in dampness. Someone over years had scraped together dikes and dug a ditch for drainage. Someone bulldozed here the roots of willows, sprouting now again as flood defence. Prop two great tractor wheels against the rusted iron barn and piles of birchwood, mossed. There's a word in this that I just need to alert you to or you'll be confused. The word buried, it refers to buried on a tree and not being buried in the ground. Across the path, an arch of thorn trees, buried now and leaning in. He planted them for her and led her, newly wed, to that hard life. Sheep on the hillside, unfenced cliff, the dog, the hens, the muddy yard. No steps cut to reach the sea, and to the neighbours the long field walk. Big house, deferential. Bridal arch, the ache. Whin, one burnt to black, and battered thorns against the hill. That blank grate. Bedroom where he loved her, where the child was born, has fallen in, is left, without comment, in the darkness, shut.
Thank you for that. So, Gerald Manley Hopkins, so when did you first come across him, or when did you first read him?
I think he was the first poet I ever discovered on my own.
Right.
When I was about 18.
Okay.
And, you know, I liked literature and English at school, but I can't remember how I came across him, but I just loved him. And I remember writing an essay that said, I think this is the greatest poem ever written. It wasn't that one.
And my teacher saying, well, I think you'd better be a bit careful saying that kind of thing, you know, for your A-levels. But I think what I loved about him and still love about him is that his language, he thinks so carefully about language, but it's so much about the ear. And as I read that poem, it was amazing to me how it's so expressive of speech, and yet it's somehow not speech, you know, it isn't speech.
Yeah, because it's so condensed, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it does feel like it's to be heard.
Yeah.
It wants to be, the words want to be heard. Don't they?
Yeah.
And I was struck listening to it that it can really chime with you as a writer.
Yes.
That sort of thing of trying to create something and give it, breathe life into it, and it's sort of not coming.
Yes,
in a way.
Yes.
I don't know if that
was definitely, definitely.
Yeah. Mm. So for you, when did poetry begin for you? When was the first, how do you think, what was your journey to being a poet, do you think?
Well, I think I probably have written poetry for a very long time. But later, within, say, the last 20 years, I was writing a bit more consistently and, you know, wanting to write prose. And I wrote some short stories which were published from time to time. And I thought I'd better try and write a novel. And I think a lot of my writing journey has been connected to my friend, the poet David Hart, who you may have heard of, Birmingham writer. And long ago, I wrote this very long prose work, and I sort of gave it to him, among other people. I didn't really know him. I'd met him, and as a literature officer or something. And so we started a kind of a writing friendship, and we shared our work. We started sharing our work long ago. And one day he said to me, "I don't think you're a novelist." And I thought, "I think you're right." And there was something about the conciseness of poetry that I like and still is, you know, the fact that it's light, or it can be heavy in what it says, but you're not carrying around this great big thing that's a novel and you have to remember, you know. So I like that sort of... and I also like the way that it can be a sort of tangential and sort of... Actually, I've got a little poem that might say that. Because I think, for me, writing poetry is very much... I never sit down and think, right, I'm going to write a poem about this. I never do that. It just won't work if I do it. And it has to be kind of... I have to approach it like it... obliquely. And in this first... my first pamphlet, A Still Dark Kind of Work, I was partly interested in... At the time, I'd been reading somebody who said, you have to pray every day. And I didn't really know what praying would be like, not having grown up in that sort of tradition. And so I asked my friend David about what he thought praying was. And this poem is called If This Was Praying. If this was praying, it's listening, you said, like writing poems. Stand somehow in the way of it. Two cramped rooms, a single bed, the bedspread blue. Come to dinner in the garden. Swept yard, rose in flower, barrow. What if that was prayer? Afternoons a robin sings. We weed the path. We sit. It's that stand somehow in the way of it that I think is what I like about poetry, writing it.
That's a sense that prayer is like really noticing where you are in the moment, feeling as well. There in the poem too. So
yes.
It reminded me a bit of the wheelbarrow poem. What's the fairly American poet for the red wheelbarrow?
The red
poem,
barrow. Is it William Carlos Williams?
Yes, it's that thing of taking the very small things that are there, and as you say, somehow standing in the way and being the person that notices those.
Yes,
and then reminding everybody who reads to notice too.
Yes,
I suppose.
I think that's very much what's impelled me to write. And for a long time, my practice of writing involved sitting down for a whole hour without and just writing without stopping, but with a certain ear for rhythm of sentences. And then I would go through I would do that every day, and on Saturdays I would go through with a highlighter and, thinking about the sound and the rhythm, highlight certain bits, not because of the sense, and then put them into poems. And it did make something in an interesting sort of way, I thought.
Mm. And do you still write like that, or has it changed?
I've struggled a bit, because I kind of wanted to let go of that.
Mm.
And then I thought, well, maybe I won't be able to do it if I let go of that. And so I still do that sometimes, because it is sort of like, as you say, catching the things that have happened in your day that are really tiny.
Mm.
The one I remember from absolutely years ago is a man pushing through a hedge, a man in a waistcoat. I'm driving along, a man in a waistcoat pushes through a hedge. And I think I need to catch those things, and by sitting like a meditation for an hour, I find I do catch those little things.
Yeah. And in a way, do you begin to tell stories about the things, do you think? Or
Not so much, I don't think. No. I think it's more about letting other things come in, like when you're meditating, you know, that your thoughts come in and you I don't know, people have different theories about meditating, but I think I like the way that things come in at a tangent, and that's why I say there isn't necessarily a kind of immediate sense that you can find in some of my poems.
Mm. And what about your work as a psychotherapist? Because that's a lot to do with dreams and hearing other people's stories, I imagine. So do you find the work comes into the work of the psychotherapy comes into your poems? Would you say there's a... they influence time?
A little bit. I mean, I think you might find one or two poems in there in-house which you could say came from that world. Not so much. I mean, I do think the connections between psychotherapy or psychoanalysis and the unconscious and poetry, I think all that is really up for discussion.
Mm.
There's a huge lot in it, and poems and dreams. I mean, I once ran a workshop called Dream Poem Dream to do with how you connect them and how they're alike and not like. Because you can't control what's in a dream. Stuff comes in and yet it has a meaning. At least I think it has. Obviously, as a psychotherapist, I think it has a meaning. But it's multiple. It's multiple meaning. And I suppose, because in the kind of therapy that I practice, I've had to have years and years of intensive psychoanalysis myself, and I have sometimes wondered whether that way of thinking was actually counter to writing poems, because an analytical thinking is really rather different.
Right. Is in
have it all sort of pre-digested somehow, and that's not what you want.
No. I mean, dreams seem to me very hard to get down on paper ever, because it's like when you wake up and you want to try and tell someone your dream, and it never you never feel like you've really got the thing that you were really that was really so important about the dream in telling. So I can see that they are separate, aren't they? The sort of dream poems you might create on the page, as opposed to real life dreams.
Yes, but, well, some of my poems have come from dreams, and now when because David and I meet every so often we meet, and I take him poems, and he says, I don't know whether this is something that's really happened to you. So some of those would be from dreams.
Right.
But not in a way that is trying to kind of tell the whole story of the dream, more in a kind of, you know, things come in.
And what about in your childhood? I mean, growing up in Ireland or any of these things? I mean, your grandma appears in your poems.
Yes.
A couple of your poems, so...
Yes, that actually, the one... I will read that one later if I get round to it.
Yeah.
It's actually my mother's grandmother that I'm talking about there. But, yes, I mean, well, my grandmother was German, in fact. My mother's family came over to England in 1926. So there are some poems that come from that, really, from sort of Germany or the Central Europe. One or two of them have that kind of feeling. And Ireland, I think, was big in terms of things like the abandoned cottages, you know, the deserted west of Ireland. And my father was an Irish historian, so we had quite a bit of Ireland in us, I think. I don't feel English.
Right, still. Yes,
yeah.
You're still, if you like.
Or Irish mixed, sort of mixed German. I was once, at a film and, oh no, it was, I can't remember now. What was it? It was one of those National Theatre live things, you know, those film things that are... And it was Coriolanus or something, and everybody went out at the interval and I carried on sitting there. And the man behind me tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Are you English?" He hadn't followed it and he wasn't English. And I just said no. you know, it's funny that.
Yeah. And was there a lot of poetry in your childhood? Was it read to you? Do you feel or?
No, not especially. No. Really, I think we did have very good English teaching,
right?
You know, really, and enthusiastic teachers.
Yeah.
And I think my father used to read us Irish fairy stories and had a lovely, sort of lilting, gentle Irish voice, and maybe that came from it.
Yeah. Mm. Ah. Well, shall we have some more poems then?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to read some poems that are sort of a little bit connected, sort of about relationships, and kind of possibly ones, well, they're sort of rather unconventional, perhaps. And I wrote this poem, this was in my second pamphlet, so it's several years old. I wrote it because I was interested in the name Hussein Bolt. The name Bolt, he'd just come into the news, and I was playing with the name Bolt. But I read this poem to somebody, and she said, "It's a love poem." And I thought... as I was thinking about that, I thought today, well, it has happened to me that I have seen somebody and looked at them and thought, "Ooh, no, I'm never going to be involved with that person." And the next thing I know, you know, few weeks or months later, I am. It's happened to me. And so maybe that's why she said it's a love poem. It's called Horse Sail. It's a bolter, that's for sure. Takes fright, it does. And yes, they tried to sell it, paraded it, that's led it by a halter, ran beside it in the auction ring, the man's coat flapping, as if it was prime stock. It wasn't. There was a shaggy coat for starters, fuzzing off its belly like a half-done moat, a dried-up yellow. Then the thin neck hanging, and the long and flaccid dick, more a bag than instrument. A broken horse, sway-backed, teetering on ballerina toes. Who'd buy that? Not me. No, never, not a chance. If nothing else, the feet would put me off. Never seen a horse with such small feet. No one had. Or seemed to know for sure, but thought he'd be unstable, old and broken-winded, and this coarse old body and the feet so neat, no chance. I think I did have somebody in mind, and so bit by bit, you know, we did sort of. And so this one is called Whiteadder Monday Evening. And what's it called when you have a little quote at the top? An epigraph. Is that it?
Is it? Or, I hope someone else can remember.
Anyway, it's in italics and it says, "Relationships are often constituted by what one dare not say to the other person." That was Adam Phillips who said that. A man was up there burning something. The air was acrid, then we saw the smoke. If we were in love, it would be fine to hide like this, for something to have come upon me. So one could account for it, lying low, not speaking. A pump was taking water from the river, or pumping something in. Flat, floodplain, wheat field, half-moon shaped at dusk. The tractor tracks were deeper, black, because the soil was sodden. And then he'd gone, the man, although the gate stood open. Don't go looking. It's evidence he's been burning. Don't go further up the path, in case. There's something. I have lost my sense of smell. I'm afraid I'll kill you. So far, no, I haven't. Imagine if ease could be possible, here in this sweet place where... Neither of us speaks. Let's go to Galloway, to the dark park there, to see the stars.
My heart is bruised. I lay at night and felt it creaking. Now, the car alarm, the hunger, an open plastic sack, someone banging nails, the clock.
This one's called Button Tie, and the title, well, there's a psychoanalytic thing that is to do with, for certain people, well, for everybody, there has to be, like a button tie, you know, in upholstery, there's a sort of a button on each side, and it holds the two sides together, and it's something that's talked about in psychoanalysis as being what kind of holds you together. This one's called Button Tie. And one light on, a naked bulb, and later smoke, and in a net, nuts for blue tits, Granny's house, a scattering outside of new split logs left where the rain will get them, the button on the mattress, old bed in darkness, deed of darkness. I see her walking fast across the green, barefaced, laughing with a red-haired youth, as if they have escaped and she is free from lipstick, earrings, home. And then her car, lights on, parked outside. He is driving. I think of turning back. There's a second's pause, and in that second, what? A gathering of parcels, a finishing, a kiss, for her to tell him something so compelling that it cannot wait. He shepherds her as men do women. She bows her head and takes her long black coat inside.
I get the feeling that we might be... Have we had nearly enough?
We can always have a bit more of a chat and then a few more poems and
shall
do
we?
It that way.
That'd be a good thing.
It's perfectly good to do that.
It's quite intense, isn't it, hearing lots and lots of poems? Shall we do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, what I'd like to do, actually, is have a bit of a closer look at the collection and ask you a bit more about it in detail, because it is very carefully structured. It's got the three parts, and then you've got these recurring things that come up over and over. So there's houses, cows, strong theme, water, lots of sea. So can you talk a bit about this and how you came to put this together? And
yeah, well, it was... I thought, well, because I approached Jane some years after I'd done From the Boat. I'd been busy with other things, and I said, you know, would you be interested in seeing some more poems? And she said, yeah. So I got the... I have a folder of poems from each year, as probably all writers do. And so I just went to the folder of poems that were from the year after From the Boat, and I picked out the best poems, what I thought were the best poems, and just put them in a pile. And I was really surprised to find... I mean, it isn't surprising in a way, is it? Because those must have been the things that I was thinking about, and those were the images I was working with, and my dreams brought them in. But it seemed sort of magical to discover that there were these... There was this... You know, it's never complete. You don't want your collection of poems to be completely coherent. It's not like writing a paper on something or other. It goes off at different... But there was a sort of coherence about it, and that surprised me hugely. And I found it quite sort of moving and magical. You know, I didn't know that that was the case. So I sent them to Jane, and then, you know, we... Jane is a fantastic editor. She's really excellent. And so between us, we put together... We thought about the different themes, and yes, the houses were one. And then another thread, which you've picked out, Chloe, is that, if you make a journey, I make a journey several times a week in my car along a country road, which possibly lots of people here do, and you kind of make a sort of funny relationship with the people and things that you see. So another little thread is this is the cows. I could read that poem.
Yeah,
shall
do.
I?
Yeah.
I want to know more about these cows. Because this poem. Man was... So this is one of them, the poems that came. I passed this sort of little plot, like kind of triangular little kind of... It's, you couldn't call it a farm, but there is a sort of barn and there's a shed and it's muddy and there's some cows. And sometimes the man's there. So this one is called I Want to Know More About These Cows. Mornings they're out, big bodies, roan, cream and grey with mottles, heavy, nose to nose. Steam rises from their nostrils, backs. This triangle of grass and mud, a pretty triangle, she said, is bordered by a stream which they could cross, the cows, by sliding down the pockmarked bank and wading. Beyond, a meadow. By noon, he's locked them in again. The black shed doors are closed. Three hay rolls, rustler stacked against them. Inside, the cows are back in fetid darkness. He himself has gone to early dinner, sleeping in his chair.
And it seems to me a lot about the male-female thing, which is very does come up in other poems as well.
Yes, yes.
And with the one you read about the man shepherding the woman in.
Yes, yes.
And she becomes almost like an object. And,
yes.
You know, she's sort of in the poem.
Yeah.
Could you say anything about that?
I hadn't thought about that. Could I? I don't know if I could. Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose, you know, there are... I don't know, is it the male-female thing? There's sort of love poems in there that are addressed to women and men, I think. And in different contexts, it's about sort of quite intense relationships that are sometimes very sort of like from the outside and in fantasy rather than and I think that's how relationships are complex.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, I did feel that in some senses, some of the poems are about a relationship breaking down.
There's a lot of that.
And obviously that works in the sense of houses too, because when you lose a relationship, sometimes you lose the house and it's part of that too. So, and was that, is that something you were aware of being as a progressive thing throughout? It felt like that was the story that was going through the poems.
Yes, I mean, I think there's, you know, there are, I don't want to tie it too much to my own life, you know, because it's never simple, that is it? It's always complicated and fantasy and how poems, I think that's another thing that, you know, poems are never, they have their own life, and so you're writing a poem and you go somewhere with it because the language and the lines and so on want to go there, not because it's true necessarily. But yes, there's a theme of losing somebody, a very strong theme of losing somebody. But also, what was the question?
About how that also links to houses and the sense of losing. It was a losing of the other things too, not just the people, but when you've lived in a house and then the objects have occupied the house and then moving and you lose those objects too. So there was a lot of, there was layers of loss actually.
I think that. Loss is a very strong theme in the earlier pamphlet as well. There is a lot of loss in it, yeah. In fact, it reminds me of... I just suddenly remembered that I hadn't read the other poems from the other poet that I wanted to think about. Do you want me to do that?
Yeah, do that.
Yeah. Lost track
I think
of
the time. If... we're doing okay, we've got 10 minutes. I think if something jumps into your mind, read it. I think that probably is a good idea.
Well, the other poet that I really like and that I thought I might read a couple of very short poems from is Gillian Allnut. Because I actually think I do write a lot about loss and I feel a little sort of self-conscious about it. In fact, as I was coming into Ledbury this afternoon and asking somebody the way to my hotel, I sort of opened the window and shouted across the road to him and said, you know where the such and such hotel is? And he said, no, are you going to the funeral? Oh God, I know I've got a black coat on, my car's black. And I know I write about loss, but I know I'm not. I've got to cheer up. But actually, you know, I can't help it really. I do write about loss a lot. And so Gillian Allnut, this collection, this is a new and selected poems, and the ones that I want to just read, which are short,
are from a kind of collection in here called Wolf Light. And these are dedicated to her mother who's just died. Well, maybe I should say I do like a good funeral. probably that level. And why I like this is I think it's got sort of like 9 lines. They're widely spaced, and they're just statements. They're not all sentences, but they're just... And I like writing like that. This is called My Mother's Bedroom. Her cheval mirror, her chevalier, her chest of drawers. Dust gatherers like us, for whom I fear. My father, hard of hearing, homed. Something must have happened. Where stars gathered together. Their silence, a silk road. They are subdued in whom darkness dwells. My mother washes her hands as usual in hospital. Her books, small, dry citadels. This one is Even Shukra. It's called Christmas 2004. Thorn and Parva, and the heart, stone, unadorned.
That's I mean, Gillian Olnott is a wonderful poet, actually.
She is.
And she came to read at the festival. I think she's got a really deep spirituality in her writing.
Yeah.
Which is lovely to read, you know. And I think it is, you know, for me, necessary that poets write about things like loss or the sort of things that can be uncomfortable, you know. Relationships ending seem to me something absolutely vital to write about, and yet sometimes it feels it doesn't happen.
Can I ask something about your voice, Mara?
Yeah.
Presumably you're also writing formal papers, articles, even books maybe about psychiatry.
Well, not psychiatry, psychoanalysis.
All right, psychoanalysis. But you are writing then
what
you call loosely academic writing.
A bit.
Yeah. Does one influence the other? Does the poetry come into your, well, let's call it academic writing or professional writing? Is there a crossover, in other words?
Well, the last paper that I wrote was about a myth, a kind of Sumerian myth called Inanna, about Inanna. And so, in a sense, maybe, you know, that I wanted to write about that and that I think, you know, a myth that's to do with her, she's queen of heaven and earth, and she goes to the underworld and is stripped naked and hung on the wall. Mm. Is that poetic? I don't know.
Well, it depends how you express it.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. I don't know. I think one of the points of writing poetry is attention to language, you know, and so I would like to think that I write in that way, also with attention to language. But I'm not sure that's answering your question.
No, it does, yes.
I think that's tremendously important. And sometimes I edit learned papers and fume about them because they're so badly, it's like eats shoots and leaves, you know. It just doesn't make sense. You think, what does this mean? I don't know. As I shout at the radio, you know.
And that's quite interesting, though, because in a way, the way you've talked about how your poems come to you, they come quite obliquely. I mean, do you question what your poems mean? Do they make sense?
That's a terrific question. Not always, no. No, I probably don't, except that they have a coherent... Well, I try not to use... Like, today, I thought I heard somebody on the radio saying... something was kick-started, and he meant started. He didn't, you know, kick-started is different, and so I was fuming about that. So they might not completely make sense, my poems, but I want to write with an awareness. I want my brain to be connected to what I'm writing. And so I think very often people, you know, in the media and in papers and whatnot, it isn't. You know, it's Orwell and the, you know, politics and the English language.
I mean, you do sound as though you know what why every word is there.
I do. But I don't really think about what that means. I don't sometimes think, that's why I said at the beginning, don't try to think too hard about what this means, because it might be like a dream. It comes in a sort of elusive way. And I don't know if I'm being contradicting myself when I say that.
Do you edit hard? Are you one of those who, you said that, didn't you, that you write a lot, then that's part of it. So taking out is a big part of
I find that if a poem isn't working, if I really edit it, that's why I like that 1.5 line one of Gillian Allnut's, that really, if you just cut everything and be brave, I find I can turn something that isn't much into something that is a bit better.
Mm. But then you've also got the knack of bringing big story, whole stories into poems. So the Llandudno one we heard, that kind of poem which seemed to tell a story of a marriage, this, you know, on this, in this hard place, using the place to tell you about the marriage. It's a whole story, but very boiled down again. I did want to ask one last thing, but I've now completely forgotten what that was going to be, and it was something about language. But I was just going to say that actually also when you read the collection, there's so much of this, so the seagull returns.
Oh yes, I've read
there's
that.
A seagull with this porcelain that, you know, and,
yeah.
And I think that can have a weird effect on you as a reader, so that I was finding I was going to bed afterwards, so I was lying there and these images or things were kept coming into my head almost in a dreamlike way, and I think that was because of the way you were repeating them through the collection. So it's a nice element, the fact that it came by surprise. Okay, but I think it's a strong element.
Yeah, good.
So, right, would you like to read a couple more poems then?
Okay. I will read the seagull one, which is really quite different from the others. This one I wrote in a different way altogether, because I briefly, I did some work in a school and with quite young children, and I asked them all to bring in an object that meant a lot to them. And I brought in this seagull, which, well, my mother had been in a nursing home before she died, and this seagull had been something that she loved when she was a child. It had belonged to her grandparents in Germany. And my sister and I took it to her in the nursing home because we thought she'd like it. And so the poem's called China Seagull. It is smooth like skin but cold, and when I lick it, it tastes like salt. We must be careful at all times and know what we want. When I see it, I think of my grandmother. I think of her house and the cellar with the jars of jam, and the garden and the orchard and the blackbirds in summer in the cherry tree by the wall. It is smooth like skin but cold, and when I lick it, it tastes like salt. We must be careful and at all times know what we want. But the seagull is smooth to the touch and cool, and I think of my grandmother and her fingers which were bent and which plaited each morning the long hair of her daughters. And I think of her house with its cellar and the jars of jam and preserves, and of the orchard and her hands stained with beetroot. My seagull is smooth like skin. When I lick it, it reminds me of salt. And of the blackbird, this last summer, in the tree by the wall. And then the last one. It's called Things Are Too Sharp. I doubt if I dare go out now in this coat of sleep. Something fast will hit me on the high street, crossing from boots to juicy fruits. Bicycles, perambulators, pushchairs. If someone offered me his arm, my son perhaps, or held my hand, took me to the prince's garden in the sun and bought me Guinness, will someone shelter me? Someone say I needn't? Someone like the tall young man who takes the lady in her purple coat daily to the post box? Can I have a window facing south, a patch of green? Go quiet, listen, watch with gentle eyes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Myra.